guys, and welcome to episode 216 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I chat with Pete Roberts. Pete is the author of the book Unknown Forces, the heartfelt story of a man struggling with mental health and his battle to live a normal life. And in this episode, we unpack his OCD story, him telling his wife he had OCD, seeing the doctor or the GP for the first time, mindfulness, being in the military, Puro, the importance of finding someone you can talk to, his book, Words of Hope, and much, much more. Thank you to Pete for giving up his time and his story, and to you guys for listening. Without further ado, here he is. On the podcast today, I have Pete Roberts, who has kindly agreed to share his story with us. Pete is the author of the book Unknown Forces, the heartfelt story of a man struggling with mental health and his battle to live a normal life. Welcome to the podcast, Pete.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. And yeah, like I always get people's OCD stories if they have one. So yeah, in as little as much detail, it'd be good to hear yours.
It's a bit of a strange tale, I suppose. I led a fairly normal life. I say normal. I had issues at school. But up until that point, there was nothing out of the ordinary until I was on holiday when I was 14, and as the family, we were in a holiday let, and as everybody else was settling down, I was just overcome with these strange thoughts. And like I said, it was a fairly happy time. It was a happy holiday, nothing out of the ordinary. And I just got this, well, it's almost like a vision of me harming my family, and I couldn't explain them. And I suppose my life changed at that point, really. I couldn't really explain, but when you get these sort of thoughts, you kind of don't believe that you've had them in the first place.
Yeah.
So you revisit, but then they sort of get hold of you then and sort of drag you down. And they stay with you. They stay with you for days. And I spoilt that holiday. I was morose. I couldn't look my parents in the eyes the following day. I've got a younger sister as well, and it sort of went from there, really. I wouldn't say they happened every day. I couldn't explain them, but over that time, for instance, my dad was a builder, and I used to help him out occasionally. I'm being positioned on the scaffold near him, I could just, it's like an urge, but it's like you, I foresee it. I run through it in my mind. And it's not, I don't want to do it. It's like a video that plays through my mind. And then obviously you convince yourself you're going to do it. Then you see yourself do it. Then even though you haven't done it, the guilt remains. And it eats away at you. And it's just sort of, so basically, that's how my life went, really. I was in college at the time as well, after having left school. I managed to get into college. I think it was a case of they needed to fill the seats because my academic record was shocking.
It sounds like my life.
Yeah. It was a case of one of my school reports basically said that I love nature because I study out the window all the time. And that's how sort of I went, really. But it never occurred, and nothing of this ilk ever happened in college. These thoughts only focus on the people I love. I went away to the Navy whilst I was at school, HMS Sultan. And during that week, actually nothing happened. That was obviously the time I was at school, but it did sow a seed even then that I would try to. I had to move away from home or run away from home. I did try to join the Navy, but they rejected me out of hand, and so having managed, thankfully, to complete and graduate from college, I could no longer live with myself. I'd even see things like my sister was younger than me, so she was vulnerable. And I could even see her. I could even see myself in the middle of the night, basically lifting her from her bed gently, taking her outside during a stormy winter's night, locking the door. And then I couldn't sleep that night, just thinking about her being outside. And she wasn't. She was happily asleep in the next bedroom. But that guilt comes back, and then you're caught in a vicious cycle, really.
Yeah.
So in essence, in full sulk mode, I decided the Navy wasn't for me. But so I joined the Air Force, having sort of prepared for it this time. When I did apply for the Navy, I hadn't prepared for it. This time I did. And they accepted me into the engineering. And I had a career of 23 years, even though, I'll be honest, I hated aircraft before I joined. And I hated them even more when I left. But they gave me a sanctuary, if you like. And in essence, I used to come home and then I'd have these thoughts. But then I always knew I could live with that, because at the end of the weekend, as a youngster, I would go back to my military life. I did eventually meet the love of my life, which is my wife. Mm. And again, you'd have these thoughts because obviously I loved her. And we had children. But then I would live away from home. In essence, coming home every weekend. And I maintained that in married life. There was one occasion where, well, there was two occasions where we, through circumstance, we were, because Sian, my wife, she insisted that when I was based in South Wales, she would, she said, like, I need to experience a bit of military life. But I knew that camp, that was RAF Brodie, it was in Pembrokeshire. It was earmarked for closure. So I knew it'd be only for about 10 months. But that was, it 10 months was very hard to endure. It was a time where, to put this into perspective, when having had two children, I was in the bath at one time. I was happily immersed in the bubbles, relaxed. And then the wife came in, and as I say in my book, dropping the kids off the pool. Mm-hmm. And whilst my wife remained in the bathroom, everything's fine. But the minute she left, I just had an it was just a terrible image of sort of drowning both of my children. In fact, I couldn't cope with those sort of thoughts. So I dressed it up as comedy, and I said in jest to my daughter, but she was quite precocious, that I'm going to have to drown you now. And then obviously the look of fear, and she arched her neck back to say, what, like this? And I was horrified. I jumped out of the bath. I was meant to wash their hair. I didn't. I just sort of wetted it a little bit. And then toweled them down and then sent them back downstairs to the mother. And then that, as life does, bites you back. As they were both marching down the stairs, my daughter turned around to my wife and said, Dad tried to drown us. And at that point, my wife sort of chuckled. And no, I just asked him to wash her hair. And what I didn't know was, that was a cathartic experience, because when you have these sort of thoughts, unbeknownst to me at the time, if you do face them, they will dissipate. But it's almost like you're saying, you have like a confliction of voices. Then,
yeah.
One will say, you know, face your fears. The other one will say, well, what if you don't? What if you don't? So at that time, I still couldn't rationalise what was going on. And like I said, I maintained my career for 23 years, really. So yes, I lived at home for periods, but the last 10 years was spent away from the family, just coming home every now and again.
Mm.
And even to this day, when I left the Air Force, my parents, they're both not with me anymore. And they're not aware. And only about 6-7 years ago, in essence, having left the military, I had no escape route. And therefore, one of the chapters is called There's Something You Should Know. And it's when I sat my wife down and I tried to explain what was going on. Comedic events tend to use comedy,
yeah,
to get myself out of sticky situations. And there's a famous Liverpool comedian called Stan Boardman. I'm not sure if you know him.
No, I don't.
Okay, you're too young. So he was on the Des O'Connell show, and he used the German aircraft. It's a Fokker Wolf, and he used the term Fokker as a double entendre for the F word, and then he never worked on telly again. But I tried to explain that one of his jokes was it's ironic, how did Britain win the Battle of Britain? Because the Germans had their aircraft all camouflaged, and we had targets on the wings. Because if you look at the, you know what I mean, how did we, and I tried to use that somehow to explain that that's what happens in my mind, that my family go in and around me with targets on their heads. But unfortunately, by using Stan Booth, and she did know who he was, she's just started laughing. And so basically, I had to say, look, and then I had to just sort of paint a picture that, coming back to that evening in Devon, when in essence, what I saw was myself with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Bludgeoning my mum, my dad, and my sister. And then obviously her face went white. And but she's part of really my catharsis, because she didn't run out the door. She, in the weeks and the days and the weeks later, she was no ostrich like I had been, and she would quiz me. She'd ask me, "What's going through your head now? What you're feeling?" And we were out walking, and I said to her, basically, I've got an urge, so it's to throw into that lake. And at that point, she made for the lake. Now, I didn't know she was going to do that. And I instinctively grabbed her arm and pulled her away. Now, that was, again, therapy, unbeknownst to me, because you can't just pretend. You can't do it yourself. You can't just pretend that you're going to introduce some realism to it. So that was similar to what happened with my daughter. In the bath, I didn't know that she would understand. I tried to dress it up as comedy, but she took it seriously, and so that helped. But still, later that year, we went to Portugal, and it's basically I'd meant to ask about getting like a flat. Or our room would be on the ground floor, but it wasn't. It was something like, I think, 14 sort of levels up. And through that week, I just foresee myself not just throwing my wife over the balcony. It would come in stages. She'd manage to hang on. And then you would just foresee myself unpeeling the fingers and looking. And the thing about it is, I see my wife looking back at me. So it's not just a case of having these, what basically are intrusive thoughts, which are a natural phenomenon.
Yep.
Everybody gets intrusive thoughts. And even people with OCD, or my type of OCD, and I'm sure you know, obviously, it's pure OCD, which manifests itself as harm. Some people, they will just get the thoughts, whereas unfortunately for me, I don't just get the thoughts. I have this sort of video that plays in my head, and then obviously the guilt then jumps on board, and it just gnaws at you. But that week was the end. It was the last sort of stage away about, yeah, I've got help. By talking to the wife, she's brought a bit of catharsis, but I couldn't continue. So eventually, after some, what amounted to over 30 years, I made an appointment to see a GP.
Yeah.
Which was a bit strange, quite a strange experience. He's a rugby fan, same as me, a Welsh rugby fan, and all I had on my records was that some back pain and some knee pain, mostly from having played rugby in my life. But and then all of a sudden, I just sort of let loose. But what I've tried to point out more than anything is the fact that the importance of opening up. I mean, that he did, in fairness to him, he was like a, and I don't blame him, it's the way that, that led up to me acknowledging that. Because I did ask him, because when I saw his eyes sort of change, having divulged such a story, I did ask him, this is going to remain between us, because in my mind, he's a doctor and I'm a patient. But then he said, not if I think you're going to act out on your thoughts. Now, at that point, I thought, why have I opened up? I've kept this quiet for 30 years. But in fairness to him, all he was doing was replying to my question, not my condition. And in fairness to him, I've even included him in the book because I owe him a lot. And there have been cases of intrusive thoughts whereby mothers, young mothers, have been subjected to them, whether that's OCD or not, or just that the, you know, basically childbirth amounts to trauma. And they've been subjected to intrusive thoughts about drowning the baby, and another of one case where the baby was taken into care until a clinical psychologist got involved and said, no, it is just intrusive thoughts. She will not harm the baby. And thankfully, the baby was returned.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I wanted to tell my story. Other people will be subjected to intrusive thoughts, not just OCD or pure OCD.
Yeah.
Or harm OCD. The proper term, psychological term, is thought action fusion, whereby you think something. Normally, people can move on, but I lock into that thought. Now, because you lock in, you re-examine. And your mind is very good at heightening the sense of danger to anything that you re-examine. And that's when the cycle begins. Then you re-examine again, because you keep re-examining. That means it will come true, hence the thought-action fusion.
Mm.
And it's come along when I use mindfulness, for instance. I started reading. Basically, it was Ruby Wax's book.
Yeah.
Because she used mindfulness. Well, it's mindfulness, CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. Because I think she had severe depression. And I started using, at that time, I read it, and then I read Mark Williams. Oxford professor.
Something like that, yeah. He's got a mindfulness book, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. Finding Peace in a Frantic World, so... I had done a taster course as well, but I use sound. I don't quite know why that works for me. So even when I shower in the mornings, I will use the sound, and it helps me tune in. I take the dog for a walk. I mean, it just, so basically, there's two aspects to this, if you like. When I talk to a clinical psychologist, he always wants you to deal with the thoughts, and that's what I wasn't doing. Until the only time, like I said, that ever happened was in the bath and when with kids and when my wife made for the lake. So that was a bit of me facing my fears. But when you do talk about CBT, it's a bit like saying, put your hand in the fire and you will feel better. Because of confliction or conflicting voices or feelings, thinking, what if you don't obviously stop yourself harming? But you put it, in essence, Ruby Wax in her book, that got my train of thought to think upon what she said. It's like being in the cinema. Now, you're not in the film. Therefore, you're watching the film. And therefore, these feelings, it's a bit like you're watching the film. So you're not in there. They're just reflections. In the clinical psychology, he used Harry Potter, of all people. Obviously, I was laughing, or I was grinning when he said Harry Potter, but the prisoner of Azkaban, all the students, including Harry, have to face their fears. And through a Bhagat, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So I think in the film, even the teacher is a werewolf, so obviously he sees the moon. And then the Dementors in the film, who are sort of hunting Harry. But that's, so basically... these thoughts are my dementors. And if you can make turn it around to be funny, then they disperse. So facing them, try to make them funny. But even the mindfulness, really, it's gives. When I used to do martial arts years ago, I tried to go heavily into it and doing sort of meditation and looking for the third eye and to find sort of be at ease with myself. But I could never empty my head. I could never empty my head of these thoughts or anything else. But with mindfulness, it doesn't ask you to empty your head. I tune myself to sound. So it's dragging me to somewhere else. It's not possible to empty my head, but I can. And like I said, I've used it quite successfully. And thankfully, again, it's been cathartic. It's been difficult writing the book because there was elements who I'd subdued. And therefore, all of a sudden, when I'm writing them, and because I found out why my issues were so severe at school, because when I was 8 to 6, I'd cracked my skull, but it brought with it what's called acquired dyslexia. So I'd suffered some brain damage, basically, which affects my processing. So that didn't help. But then with mindfulness, it's a case of being able to. I've got techniques. And you asked me before we came on air how I was, and because the real sort aspect of my intrusive thoughts was they're always worse at Christmas. They only focus on the people I love. There's more carnage to be had at Christmas time than any other year. It's like having your own Christmas card saying, "Behold, greetings," and 2 weeks of endless intrusive thoughts. But I'm able to function normally. I've moved on. Hopefully, I can get people to look at my sort of story and talk about it, because that's the thing I didn't do. I just basically ran away from home, didn't talk about it. But then, I joined the Air Force in 1984, and these things happened in the 70s, so way before the internet or anything else, so there was nothing. And also been in the military as well. Military is very proactive these days about PTSD. But there was a time during the Falklands, I wasn't in the military during the Falklands War, but I joined shortly afterwards, and the first Gulf War. So there were veterans from both of those conflicts, and they would have been medical discharged, because they couldn't. The military has an ethos of service before self. Right, so and obviously you have the other sort of aspects that underpin it, like you're only as strong as your weakest link. So you're conditioned really not to open up. Again, young men these days, especially that aspect hasn't changed, but hopefully society will start to change even more so, and people will open up, people will share. It's funny. I'm really glad that of the opportunity on the podcast, because I was interviewed for a local paper, and the journalist I spoke to was, again, same as yourself, very sympathetic and everything else, but then they put me on the front page next to Jeremy Corbyn, would you believe? And they dropped the word OCD. So basically, on the front of the page was my sort of picture and the words, college lecturer has lived with thoughts of killing his family on the front page.
Yeah.
If they read, anybody that read the feature or the article inside, obviously you then understand it's OCD. But not when you're on the front of the newspaper.
Yeah.
And he hadn't told me either. I just went in for a sandwich, and it was head high going into the shop, and then it was me and Jeremy Corbyn. So yeah, that's my claim to fame. I probably cost him the election.
I was going to say, sure. Yeah, it probably damaged his votes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about me doing a headline like that.
The thing is, I'm in control of what I say rather than.
Yeah.
And
course.
I told them his OCD. They decided to sort of drop the OCD side because you represent OCD stories, so you've got a vested interest in portraying that, which is I'm glad of the opportunity.
Yeah. No, my pleasure. No, thank you so much for sharing that and going into so much detail. One thing, I want to dig a bit deeper on. So you mentioned about Pure O, which is and yours being focused on harm. But as we know, there's always compulsions with Pure O. They're just usually mental and not physical, like door checking or washing hands, whatever it is. It seems to be like avoidance was a big one of like avoiding, I guess, your kids and maybe your loved ones. Were there any other like asking for reassurance or anything like that you were doing?
No, because to be honest with you, it's why it's so complex, OCD, because I don't have behaviours. And I know that, you know, so with PRO, some people will not have the thoughts or have the behaviours. A lot of the people, it's the interest of the thoughts that causes the behaviours. So I think, yeah, you're right, I would have reacted to the behaviours, but I don't have anything, any behaviours as such that drive it. It was just the thoughts. And then because I've got, like I said, it's almost like a video that opens out. The best example I've tried to explain to people, there was a chimp in America, Travis, I think he was called. So he'd been sort of raised in the house, and then a family friend who knew the chimp, and I think she played with one of his favourite toys. Well, the chimp was aging, and the chimp attacked the family friend, and she was terribly disfigured.
Mm.
But in that process, the owner went to get a knife and sort of plunged the knife into the chimp, and the chimp turned to his owner, and she said, it was almost as if the chimp was saying, why, mother? Well, that's the sort of reaction. When I was to think of harming the family, was that I would see their reaction.
Mm.
It isn't just me harming them. For instance, if you were drowning somebody, you would see them looking back at me. And I want to let go, but I see myself not. And I tried to explain this in essence to my wife once when I said, it's almost like you're harming the member of your family, but there's a crowd of people near you, all shouting. And she thought, what, encouraging you? No, the crowd of people are telling me to stop. But the foremost face in that crowd is me.
Mm.
And it's an excellent question by yourself. Obviously, you know all about OCD, but I don't have necessarily the behaviours that would have spotted those behaviours at home. Without thinking, I would have certain things like I have hammers. I could never leave a hammer in the house. So the thing is, I'd go back to my military life, and my wife would want to put a picture, and she had to go to B&Q to get a new one because I'd hidden the hammer in the garage and out of sight, you know, out of sight. Knives, not so much. Kettles used to have because when you think about it, if you've got a boiling kettle pulsating in your hand,
yeah,
that is really it's a terrible experience. So
yeah, terrible.
I suppose I did have behaviours when I think about them now, but because I think myself lucky in essence, because other people with these sort of behaviours, they're enslaved to them, aren't they?
I
found a way, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the reason I ask is it's sometimes a misconception with Pure O, because there are compulsions in the sense of, like, the things people do to nullify or avoid those thoughts. So, like, removing the hammer would be a compulsion. Relaying thoughts over and over in your head, trying to, would I do this? Wouldn't I do it? Did I do that? That's a compulsion as well. It's just often not seen as a compulsion because it's not
you're right.
You know, the check-in.
You made me think, though.
All right, no, thank you. There's so much detail there.
I mean, that was the biggest compulsion, was running away to the airport.
Well, yeah, that's a big one.
When I had no interest in aircraft.
Yeah, good point. Well, I'm guessing you liked engineering, though.
Or not? Yeah, I'm not. I'm actually, I've been diagnosed as a dyspraxic as well.
Okay, yeah.
So I'll be honest with you. It's a case of, I'm a lecturer myself now, so and I'm a specialist tutor as well. I've qualified with the British Dyslexia Association.
Oh, cool.
So I teach other people about dyslexia and dyspraxia. But I would need multiple occasions to embed learning, and obviously in the military, that didn't always occur. And I've been dyspraxic with, I mean, I could play rugby and everything else, and I used to box as well, but could never skip. So that's how my imbalance affected me. But the worst one was shooting. So we'd go on the range, and then the bloke would be lying next to me, and then we'd have 30 rounds. And then on one occasion, you're meant to get a small group in, so that shows accuracy. But they accused me of having a shotgun because my holes were all over the place. Then we counted them. I had 28, and the guy next door to me had 32. So I'd shot two of mine into his target. So I wasn't in the great shakes, really, But what I was conscientious, and I would learn from my mistakes. And being dyslexic as well, I would turn the negative into a positive. So I was more likely to go back and check something than somebody that wasn't dyslexic and would be more, if you like, arrogant, thinking that, yeah, I get it right all the time. But it's same as OCD. I look at it as a superpower because in the kitchen, I'll see the oven door open. I'll see that maybe there's a saucepan on the front burner and it should be at the back. I'll see the kettle with that lid on. And now I can focus on, and I deal with those before anybody else has even had a thought. So I do look upon it. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I do look upon it now as almost like a mixed emotion, really.
Yeah. No, fair enough. What was there like any big epiphany or light bulb moment in your recovery journey? Something that just clicked for you.
What?
Like an understanding of how OCD works or how to get better from it or anything like that. Anything that just made sense.
Yeah, I think it was the meeting with a psychologist, because obviously I'd read books, I'd done a taster session on mindfulness and everything else, but it's the epiphany, I suppose, came actually, you know, it was a television program. There's a television program, I think it was S4C. Initially, the young lass, in fact, she had Down syndrome, I think, and I just caught the program halfway through, and then all of a sudden, she let out this scream, and then it was being narrated, and the narrator said it's in reaction to the knife, and it was a chef's knife. And that sort of my mind, but I thought wrongly, I thought that's OCD, that's just people with, you know, shamefully, that's just people who've got like compulsions of cleaning and all. I knew nothing really about OCD. But it was a follow up program, and this time it was a graduate, and in essence, she was sat next to a psychiatrist, and he produced a knife from under the table and willed her to use it against him. So that got me. So that, I suppose, that was the aspect of it. So she never obviously picked the knife up and harmed the psychiatrist. So I suppose, I think on the road to total sort of catharsis, I think that was a pivotal point to me. You've got to remember that was perhaps in the 90s. Again, before maybe the internet, where you can just. But I think that's the problem with OCD in itself, because people still think it's all to do with the behaviours, without realising it's not necessarily, and without realising just how enslaved those people are. And also that they generally think unless they engage in those behaviours, a member of their family will die or they will die. And I just hope I can add a little bit of knowledge to you know, the realism behind OCD.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that you are doing on this episode. Yeah, so it was. So you saw that in the TV show, the psychologist asked her basically to pick up the knife and scare him or just hold it near him or whatever it is.
He placed it right between them, and then she was visibly shaking. And basically she said, "I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it. Do it." At no point did he say, "You won't do it." Mm. He just said, "Do it." Pick the knife up. And obviously she didn't. So basically that was her bugger.
Yeah.
That was her facing her fears. And so basically what you need to do is the total opposite of what I did. I ran away from my problems. Mm. Maybe understandably. However, don't run away from your problems. Share your problems and find somebody that you can talk to.
Yeah, absolutely. Good advice. And you've obviously talked about your book already, but is there anything else about your book that you want to share?
It's funny. it's got some anecdotes in the military and life in the military, so it's not all doom and gloom. And I think it's part of the inspirational series, so I don't like bigging myself up, but it's not a bestseller, don't get me wrong, but it's a truthful story of my memoir. And it's funny in parts, it's dark in other. It's got aspects of dementia in there because my father, and it's funny, I never experienced, because basically after I left the Air Force for a period of 3 years, I looked after my father, and I never experienced any wish to harm him when he had dementia. Before joining the Air Force, there was all sorts going through my mind, but never at that point. So it's a case of, it's about OCD or Puro. It shows how somebody that is dyslexic and castigated really at school, and again castigated in the Air Force. One of my instructors in the Air Force said to me once, "Son, you can't polish a turd." And so again, I'd like to meet that person once more, because I'm in the final throes of completing my master's in education. But it's one of them things where, sorry,
I'd say good for you, man. Really,
yeah,
good.
thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And you're very easy to talk to, which I was a bit nervous before.
All good, man. Don't worry, I still get nervous even doing this on my end. So, all right. So, just general words of hope for those with OCD.
It's basically we all have issues. I'm not a psychopath, and I just got intrusive thoughts. It's a natural phenomenon. It's worse with Puro, and it manifests itself in horrible. But it's funny. It's like I said, I think of it now as a superpower. I see danger before other people. I react to that danger. I've got my mindfulness to move me away if they remain. But if you face your fears, it's a bit like having an unwanted guest. Open the door for those thoughts, and they will disappear.
Absolutely. Yeah, good words. And then a couple of quick questions, which is, if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell him?
Don't join the Air Force. Yeah. or decide. I was 21, actually, so that's a good question, because that would have been just about the time when I was contemplating what to do. And talk to somebody. I think that's the biggest thing. Mm. It's one of the reasons. I don't know what my 20-year-old would have been able to do in the 1980s. But it shows you that life has moved on, society has moved on. We're not yet there yet, especially with OCD. I don't think there's any other condition that's either misdiagnosed or misunderstood. So I think it would have been a case of just open up to somebody at age 20. And then, but I don't regret. I mean, I managed to become a service instructor, and therefore now I love teaching. I love making a difference to young students. So in essence, life's been good to me as well. I've been dealt some weird things in my head, but I don't think I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't been given OCD.
Yeah, absolutely. And then last question is, you've got a billboard where you live. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
I'm Pete. I'm a nice guy. I have two OCD and I'm not a psychopath.
Yeah. And buy my book.
Please buy my book.
Yeah. And thank you so much for your time today. I've really found your story inspirational.
Well, I get a bit emotional now, but thank you very much for the opportunity. And I've enjoyed it now. I was a bit apprehensive before, but thank you very much.
So there you have it. Thanks again to Pete for sharing his story and to you guys for listening. And a quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Till we speak, take care.